There's a story in the Zen world of a Zen teacher named Tozan Ryokai, and he was is considered the founder, one of the founders of Soto Zen in China. And there's a little story about his enlightenment or some kind of deep understanding that he had. And he'd been a practitioner, a monk, for many years already. So a practitioner, among other things, is someone who, whether directly or indirectly, explicitly or implicitly, is questioning the idea of the self. Who are you? Or another angle would be is questioning all the different beliefs we have about what I am. So you might have the belief that you are your thoughts, or you are your feelings, or you are your body, or you are your, who you really are is your ethnicity, or your gender, or your role in society. That's who you really are. And some of these beliefs are not that conscious. I mean, consciously, some people don't believe they are their car. You know, that's, you know. However, there's some people, when their car disappears or gets damaged, you know, they realize how much they use their car to define who they are. And they're, you know, for example, or their clothes or their hair or something. Some of us believe our hair is really who we are, our clothes. The joke is supposed to be that people choose their clothes more carefully than they choose the words they speak. And so the idea is you identify with your clothes. Somehow the clothes define who I am. Or that definition is a way of showing the world who I want you, who I want you to believe I am. And so there's this whole game that we do called representation. We use something to represent ourselves. And if you divide up the re and the present, it means you present again. As if you're not good enough the first time, you feel like you have to present yourself in some special way. And so we put on special clothes or special roles, or we behave in particular ways because we want people to see us in a certain light. So for example, it's really important that people see me as being a kind person. So we kind of, everything we say comes out of our mouth is kind of kind. Or maybe it's important to see myself, to show myself, to represent myself as being tough. And so everything I say is kind of harsh and tough because, you know, that's how you get respect. And so people spend a lot of time representing themselves, trying to present a certain side of themselves. And sometimes we know this is not who I really am, but, you know, this is what I'm trying to do. To be safe, or to be approved of, or be accepted, or be part of the gang, or part of the society, or whatever. And sometimes we know it, and sometimes we don't. Sometimes we believe the representation. We believe the game, the mask that we're trying to present to the world. We believe that's really who we are. So one way or other, Buddhist practice is questioning this whole idea of how we define ourselves, who we take ourselves to be, and ultimately offering another alternative to how to be alive that's not based on the various selfing games that people play, the selfing strategies, building up self, making self, creating a sense of I, presenting a sense of I. So this man, Tozan Ryokai, had spent years of practice. And there's one of the kind of, directly or indirectly, he was probably addressing these kinds of issues. And then one day he was walking across a bridge. And he stopped and he looked over the edge of the bridge into the water below. And he saw his reflection. And he realized, looking at that reflection of himself, he said, "That is me. But I am not it. That is me, but I am not it." And so the question for you is, why was that a significant statement? why was that a significant realization, understanding for him? That is me. So it's his reflection. He's not looking in and seeing somebody else's reflection there. He sees a reflection, it's not a fish. He sees a reflection and it's, you know, it's not some imaginary idea, you know, look, see an image in the clouds, you see a horse in the clouds, the clouds are configured. It's not like he's looking down at the ripples in the water and saying, well, that looks like me. He's seeing his reflection, it's his reflection. So that it is me. But I am not it. So anybody like to make some suggestions about why this was a significant understanding for Tozan? Yes, please.
Something like shadow and light casting off of the water, illuminating himself in some form of energy.
So shadow and light, energy, kind of light reflecting off the water, that's what he saw. And so in a sense, it's a reflection of him, but that limited quality of reflection, light and dark, shadow and light, that couldn't be him, right? Because
he's... Well, I was speaking metaphorically like in an energy force, mm-hmm. something like an aura, something like that in energy.
I'm being an aura, maybe. Okay.
I guess what I think of is the reflection shows some aspect of him, but he is much more than that.
So the reflection shows some aspect of him, but he's much more than that.
Possibly he recognized himself, but he didn't identify with it.
So he recognized himself, but he didn't identify with it. What does that mean?
Well,
doesn't your driver's license identify you?
To the police, I guess. it's hard to you get into duality with identifying with the other. It's semantics. When it's an echo in a sense, a reflection in a way is an echo. It's not the original, uh-huh. but it is a... It emanated, but it's not it.
Okay, great. Thank you. So right in front of you here, you pass it.
Hello. Is this on?
Okay. Yes.
One of the ways I would think about it is that the self is defined by dualism. What we are is in terms of other things. Uh-huh. So by him saying that's not me, I'm not, means he's not defining himself in terms of that. So when you get down to it, the self is really nothing but a comparison. If you claim a self, it's nothing but a comparison to other objects. And by taking that away, that comparison, you don't have a self.
So the self is a comparison. It's something that arises out of comparison to other things, all things which are not self in a sense. But if you take away the comparison, then you know there's no self. And that line of reasoning is very similar to, somewhat in some circles, at least Buddhist circles, famous definition of conceit. Conceit being kind of unfortunate, unhealthy activity of the mind. And conceit is in Buddhism is considered to consider yourself to be superior to others, as it's often considered here in the English word of conceit. But mana, the Pali word, also means in addition to considering yourself superior to others, also means considering yourself to be inferior to others. And it's also considering yourself equal to others. So what's left? And what's left is you don't compare. Don't bother. That's what's left. So So similar to what you're saying. So maybe help here.
Really, he meant that he is self, and the image he's saying is the manifestation of the self.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, he is not the shadow. He's not. That's a manifestation.
Mm-hmm.
Like we are the self. In the real sense, we are the manifestation of the bigger self.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Go ahead. Maybe two more.
So I just took it to mean sort of somewhat similar to what this gentleman said. The first half of the statement was the ordinary understanding, that's me, that's my physical form, that's my outward appearance. And then the second half is the sort of deeper understanding that physical form, that body, that personality that's showing up even in the water is not self, is not anything. There's no sort of there. There's no essence to it. So that's what I took it to mean. So between the first and the second parts, he comes to this understanding that I have a body, but that's not my body, for instance.
Uh-huh. And you might also, in that light, you might point out that the reflection is in the river. And the river is a popular metaphor for things that are constantly changing. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that you see the self there, but the self is something that's constantly changing. What's constantly changing doesn't qualify as some permanent notion of self, perhaps. So here, Marilyn.
Dogen causes the reflection, but the reflection doesn't cause. I mean, he can look over and create the reflection, but the reflection can't create him. And I mean, in my own personal experience, it happens a lot. My projections take over me and start, you know, running me around. So.
So for Tozan, he created the projection in a sense, but the projection doesn't create him. But in your case, you create the projection, and then the projection creates you.
Yeah, like the just taking that, realizing that you caused the projection, and the projection doesn't cause you.
Ah.
Causality.
So to be awakened or enlightened for you is to see the projection and leave it as a projection. And to be unenlightened, perhaps, is to believe the projection, have the projection come back at you, and you kind of inhabit the projection.
Right.
Something like that?
Yeah.
So another famous Chinese Zen story of the painter who's painting a very realistic dragon. And he's up very close in canvas painting the dragon. And then he finally steps back to look at what he's created, get the bigger picture of it. And it's so realistic, it frightens him and runs away. So some of us create, you know, a very realistic idea of who we are. And in fact, some of us are frightened by what we see, what we created, the image we created. So, you know, it is not me, but I am it. So it is not me, but it is not me. Oh, Jesus. It is me. But I am not it, right? And so the idea that certainly anything that we point to and say, this is me. So it could be reflection, it could be an idea, it could be a feeling, it could be someone else's projection, it could be a sensation in your body, anything you point to, and this is me, is seen as being false. It is not. So it is me in a certain degree, but I am not it. So there's a tendency sometimes in Buddhist circles for some people who hear the Buddhist teaching of not self to want to very quickly dismiss anything as being self. Saying there is no self, people say. There is no self. And in extreme forms, you find people who will walk around kind of like Buddhist zombies. Saying, you know, you ask them, how are you? And they say, can't answer that question. there's no me here. or you know, how are you? And they say, oh, there's a, you know, there's a lot of heat happening and vibration. And you say, what? but you look angry. You know, and so there's a way that not owning anything as being me, and kind of pushing everything away, and you kind of get a sense sometimes you're not really seeing anybody there or feeling anybody there. No ownership in a sense. And then of course the opposite is too much ownership, too much identifying, to holding on tight, not wanting to let anything go. And Tozan, in a sense, is kind of seeing both sides. He's saying, it is me. There is kind of ownership there, some responsibility, some saying, there is a connection to that reflection in me. There is a connection. But I'm not going to limit myself to that reflection. I'm much more than that, as some of you said. And what is that more? If you try to define that more, then you have another reflection. As soon as you define what's more, then you have something that you're pointing to again. You say, by saying, oh, that's me. Of course, your physical appearance can't be your true self, right? We all know that. We don't take our, you know, our physical beauty or ugliness or, you know, clothes as being our true essential self. We're all wise enough to that, right? But then we say, well, that's not me, but, you know, this wonderful feeling of wholeness that's inside of me, that's really me. Or my intention, my motivations, my aspirations, that's really me. You're just taking something else as being the reflection. You're pointing to something, that is me. It is you, but you're much more than that. As soon as we define something and limit ourselves to that, we're limited, we're contained, we're contracted. And so the other side of the equation is, I am not it. It is me, but I am not it. So it's taking some ownership, some responsibility for what's there. So these people who walk around Buddha zombies, part of the difficulty with them is they don't take responsibility for what's going on, the feelings, the thoughts, the words, anything. But there is a sense of responsibility. You know, it is I, but I am not it. So then you can say, well, of course, anything that's limited can't really be who the true self is. The true self is unlimited. That's just another reflection. That's another idea. Saying, you know, the self is unlimited. As soon as you try to define the self, you run into some certain kind of problems. So is there an alternative to defining the self? Just as is there an alternative to conceit? The alternative to conceit is not to play the game of comparison. The alternative to defining anything as a self is not to try to define anything as self, not live in a world that requires you to have a self-definition. But at the same time, taking responsibility for your feelings, your thoughts, your impulses, your aspirations, and everything. When I was a new Zen student, I had a kind of informal conversation with a Zen priest. And he said to me, there are two routes to kind of understanding the self. They go in opposite directions, but they come out to the same place. One is the route of negation, where you see that everything, that there is no self. You see, nothing qualifies as a self. And the self kind of disappears in that negation process. The other route is to see that everything is a self. And one of the very famous quotes in the Vipassana world comes from a Tibetan teacher, I think it was Kala Rinpoche, and the quote goes something like this: wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. And between the two, my life flows. Between those two. So love tells me, wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. And between the two, my life flows. So to take a route, either way, if somehow the self disappears in both ways, And so it is me, but I am not it, allows you to disappear, allows you to become transparent. So another way of talking about this is, self-disappearing or self-becoming infinitely large is both routes can be significant for people. So the route of becoming big is there was once a fly that landed on the back of an ant. And it was a big deal for the ant. The fly was heavy, and the ant tried to shake the fly off, tried to beg for mercy, tried to, all kinds of ways to get that fly off. Finally, the fly flew away, and the fly flew and landed on the back of an elephant. It was not a big deal for the elephant. The elephant hardly noticed. So the question is for you in this analogy, what kind of clothes do you wear? Do you wear the clothes of an ant or the clothes of an elephant? Many people wear the clothes of an ant, and everything that happens to them is such a big deal, has such a big impact, weighs them down. Everything that happens to them kind of, some people are constantly negotiating the world by trying to see what's happening in the world feeds back on defining themselves, saying who they are. Is this good for me? Is it bad for me? Is this building me up or knocking me down? Is this critical of me or is this praising me? It's all in reference to the self. And that's being like an ant. And the world is the fly. An elephant, to be an elephant, is to feel yourself so big that the affairs of the world doesn't affect you so much. Someone tells you that your mother wears army boots. Most of us are big enough to take that. But there's all kinds of things that can happen that trip us up. We're wearing the clothes of an ant. And part of the function of Buddhist practice is to put on the clothes of an elephant. Still clothes. It's still kind of a thing, but you can actually kind of feel it quite big. So when I was a number of times in my practice, I felt the shift from being small to becoming big. And one example is when I was in the kitchen in the monastery. The first day I came in the kitchen in the fall, I'd never worked in a kitchen before, and the kitchen appeared to me really big, and I was really small. And then I spent a whole year working in the kitchen, kind of mastering the kitchen work. I got pretty good at it. And then I remember the last day I was going to work in the kitchen the following fall. And I knew it was my last day. And I walked in the kitchen, and the kitchen seemed really small, and I seemed really big. The kitchen's dimensions of the kitchen hadn't changed in a year. And I hadn't grown or shrunk much in a year. But somehow the sense of my presence in relationship to the room had changed with my mastery over the room. I wasn't intimidated by it so much. And a number of times in my life, I have seen where certain situations where I felt kind of small or intimidated or insignificant in relation to something, that somehow I grew or developed or something, and I became bigger than the situation. Bigger than just, sometimes things that were quite intimidating. And sometimes I have that relationship to Buddhism. When I was a new practitioner, Buddhism seemed like so huge. It's one of the great world religions. Who am I? A little puny little 20-year-old who's going to try to deal with this big world religion and struggle with it and all that. And some of you know the story I like to tell of when I was pretty new to this Buddhist practice stuff. I sat down to meditate one day, and it was a Zen sitting. So you sit facing the wall, like this far away is the wall. And this, and I hallucinated, which I don't do, in ordinary life or ordinary minds. But somehow that happened. And this massive Roman column rose up in front of me. And written down the column, it's kind of a Roman column that shows majesty and authority, like the fronts of banks, right? And so written down the column was their letters engraved in painted black with the letters Z-E-N. I was a Zen student, right? And then I went in this, and I don't know where the hallucination stopped and reality kicked in, but as I remember it, I went to embrace this column. As I did that, the column vanished. And I fell forward, hit my head against the wall. So, you know, Buddhism was this great big Zen, you know, this big, big authoritarian thing, you know, something you'd hold on to for stability and just bigger than you and provide safety and all that. And over the years that I practiced, Buddhism has shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. It's gotten smaller. And, you know, until finally, you know, I don't actually think Buddhism exists. So, you know, that might be a problem, but for some of you. And so, you know, there's kind of, you know, your sense of self changes over time. And then there's another approach, you know, disappearing. So the things in life can bother us. So, you know, it's kind of, it can be noisy here to meditate here at IMC. There's a lot of traffic sometimes. People come in late and the door opens and closes. Sometimes people come in the middle of sitting and they walk across a creaky floor and they get their zafus and you hear all the creaky stuff and all kinds of sounds can happen. And so we hear sounds, the sounds occur. And then what happens to that sound when it kind of travels through us? If, and we have this English expression, hooks. You know, I have these hooks inside of me, which means that things get stuck there. Or I like to think of barriers. We stick up a barrier, and the sound hits the barrier. So like one barrier would be, this is my precious meditation time. That is really, really important for me to get concentrated. And I'm really kind of, you know, This is my chance to get concentrated and enlightened, and so I'm going to protect myself from everything else. Everything, nothing has to bother me. Nothing should bother me. Nothing should interfere with my meditation. My meditation. And so it's hitting something. It's hitting the sense of my, that sense of identity. And it hits it. And it's not necessary to hold up that barrier, that hook. And it's possible to relax that hook, and the sound goes right through. It isn't that the sound bothers us, but we're bothering the sound. We're interfering with the sound. So a lot of different things happen in life. And the situations of life are things that happen, and they can encounter something inside of us. It's a belief, an attachment, a fear, something that we've created, we've put up, a hook that we've created. And so rather than one strategy is to keep what's up, but then try to fix the world around us. Lock the door so no one comes in to meditate after us, so no one makes any sounds. And or come and complain, someone, you know, shush everybody. And that's one approach, is try to fix the world. Another interesting approach is to relax whatever it is that's being held up. And then the sounds, the events of the world, don't strike anything. Now, one of the things that the experiences of the world strike is the sense of self, the self-representation, the self-concept, the self-projection that we have, the self-identity. So it's possible to relax that sense of self, that sense of self, not hold on to it, not wave it. And when it waves, then the things of the world is not going to attack you in the same way. So if I identify strongly with my car, the car that I drive proves my manhood. Then if my car has to go into the shop and get repaired, and I'm given some beat up old little, I don't know what. Subaru, yes. Imagine that. Not even red. Then, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of, you might think that I'm not really a man, right? Because I'm not just driving that big red car. And so the sense of self, the idea of manhood being defined by the car, is somehow, that's what I'm holding up. But if I'm not, kind of don't have that up, the sense of that idea of manhood that I have to defend and prove, then it doesn't matter the experience of what car I drive. It just kind of, So the idea of as we relax, the sense of self, parts of it becomes transparent, becomes kind of invisible, or transparent, or translucent, or just kind of empty. It just passes right through us, this emptiness of self. So the Subaru is not, the Subaru is me, it's my Subaru right now, but I am not the Subaru. I'm much certainly more than the Subaru, but also I'm not going to define myself by the Subaru. I'm going to let myself be big, perhaps, much bigger than the experience of a car, or I'm going to let myself be empty, gloriously empty. So to say, as Tozan says, it is I, but I am not it. That part that I am not it is really important. And rather than trying to define what that I is, that's not it. It's possible to just be empty. Another way of saying being empty is to say you're relaxed. Just be very relaxed about this whole thing of self. So, any thoughts? Any questions? Yes.
I have a question. To carry the analogy of the hooks, what about when someone hurts you?
So what about when someone hurts you? Well, there certainly can be lots of hooks in there that people can have. So I think it's important to see two sides. There's a side of what we're doing, our contribution to our suffering. So, for example, someone might intentionally cause me harm, but it might actually touch some identity that I have. It might threaten some identity I have that I'm holding up, that maybe is extra, not needed. And some people, for example, get hurt by people, and then they get, for some, whatever reason, they get attached to hold on to being the victim, or get attached to blaming someone else. And blame is a little bit different than holding on to the blame. So there can be kind of things that we do that we create. The question is, if someone hurts us, should we just be a pushover? Should we just kind of leave it, let it go? And I think in Buddhism, you should know. You can look. Buddhists have a practice of looking at what their contribution to clinging is. Are you clinging to anything? But then still, go back, and if you can, take care of yourself in the situation. So how do you take care of yourself in the situation depends on the situation where you're hurt. Sometimes it's enough to say, stop. I don't want you to keep doing that. And that's enough. Sometimes you can't say that, and the best thing to do is to leave and get out of there. Sometimes the best thing to do is to call the police. And that's what you should do. Sometimes you ask for mediation, you know, facilitator, come and help. And sometimes, there was a famous Indian Buddhist teacher who, there was a woman who, someone had tried to rob her or something in the streets of India. And she kind of had fended herself off, fended the attacker off. And then she went to the teacher and said, you've been teaching loving kindness, you're teaching all this, being very kind and compassionate all the time. And I was attacked in the streets. What should I have done? And he said, my dear, with all the loving kindness you can muster up, take your umbrella and hit it over the head of the guy. So your question is huge, and probably I should have asked you some questions for clarification, but what I'm trying to say is there's two sides. There's a practical side, and the practical side should never be ignored. And but there's also the inner side, the practice side, and that is, what are we doing given this has happened to us? And what can we do? What should we do in looking at ourselves? What's within ourselves? And then if we look at ourselves inwardly, then we realize that maybe different things are needed inwardly. sometimes what's needed is a lot of compassion, care, love for ourselves, given that we've been hurt. And sometimes what's needed is a very ruthless looking at ourselves and understanding how we're holding, gripped, and attached to something we don't need to be attached to. Does this speak to you? Make sense? Sorry?
I wouldn't say it makes sense, but it's just a hard
issue. It's what?
It's a hard issue.
It's a hard issue. Yeah. Please.
Last week you talked about Martin Luther King. And the woman that you talked with, we stood on the street, heard the word back day after day.
And finally, finally the person who was attacking her paused and said, "What are you doing?" Her, you know, what would you say was her state? And what had she come? What did she have to come to be able to do that? In the sense of what you're talking about, as the hooks and the rest of it. How do you see that?
So, what does it take, for example, to the people? So Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi. Trained people before they went off and did civil disobedience. They trained people. So what kind of training, what kind of preparations required to be able to stand for a cause, fight for a cause nonviolently, where you know you're going to put yourself in harm's way and still be willing to, because it's counterintuitive, you know, most of the people. So certainly one of the biggest things is a person has to deal with their fear and not be afraid, or not to let the fear have the upper hand. And that's a whole training to work through fear. Fear, all kinds of fears come into play. Fear of pain, fear of death, fear of all kinds of things. Another is a person has to work through their anger. So that anger doesn't get the upper hand. Rage doesn't get the upper hand. And so there has to be some way of working through anger, or have the anger at least, you know, not be something that catches us, works on us. Related to that is sometimes people have to work through their beliefs. Sometimes there are beliefs that we've inherited from our society or family or various places about how certain things get taken care of. And some people are quick at the trigger. Some people believe that the only way to get the way in the world is through aggression. Through aggressive voice, perhaps, or aggressive stance, posturing, or aggressive action. And so there has to be some re-education about what are those beliefs, so that those beliefs don't catch us and force us and compel us to act in a certain way. There might also have to be re-education or re-understanding about the sense of self, who we are. And it can be humiliating. From certain points of view, it can be humiliating to be in the gutter and having people kicking you and beating you. And in many situations, we shouldn't allow that to happen. But there's a greater cause that the civil rights people were working against. And because of their cause, it gave a certain ability and power to what they were doing. They weren't just allowing themselves to be beaten up, but they were actually saying something very powerful to a whole nation. So both the sense of self, that, you know, how we read into it, might have to be lessened or relaxed. But also certain things we have stopped believing in, and other things we have to start believing in. So they have to understand the power, the impact those kinds of action have. I think so. So it's kind of re-education. So I have a tremendous belief that the short-term solutions of aggression have long-term negative consequences. So in the short term, you can sometimes aggressively get your way, but in the long term, maybe it's not so useful. So the trick is to find non-aggressive ways to protect yourself, take care of yourself, and make what you need to do happen. And so there's a lot of ways, a lot of training people can do to learn non-aggressive ways to work with conflict. And one of the ways, which is relatively popular these days, which I think we're going to have a training here at IMC in about a month, is non-violent communication. So non-aggressive communication, learning the skills of that. So that's my answer. So last one, Jennifer.
It's just a comment that I really appreciated what you said. We were quoting the Zen priest about the sort of two paths to the same ending of this understanding of not self. Because sometimes when I look inside myself, I see all variety of different personas, from sort of angel to axe murderer, and I'll get very identified, and sometimes it's not easy to see during those times how that has anything to do with, you know, coming to some broader understanding of not self. But the end result is almost always that if I look and I see, oh, that too, then after a while it's like, well, oh, I'm all of that. You know, so then what am I? Well, not really much of anything that I can pinpoint. Certainly not this one thing that seems like the most outward thing. So it does seem like in the end those two converge. But I've never heard that before, so it was helpful.
Great. So some of you I'll see again in 2 months. So you have 2 months to realize. And we'll come back and I'll celebrate your realization with us. So thank you, and I look forward to seeing you soon, I hope.